From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. While state government has passed groundbreaking legislation like Assembly Bill 32, otherwise known as AB 32, the Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006, and initiated a cap-and-trade program to address greenhouse gas emissions to slow or reverse climate change, little attention has been paid to adapting to the changes in our climate that, according to data, have already been occurring. What, if anything, can be done to adapt to the subtle changes in California's climate? We'll examine the issue with Carol D'Alia, the executive director of California's nonpartisan Little Hoover Commission. We'll also hear from Roger Isom, president and CEO of the Western Agricultural Process Association, which represents tree nut haulers and processors of almonds, pecans, pistachios, and walnuts throughout California, and Mark Grassi, an award-winning environmental reporter for the Fresno Bee. Climate change, adapting to a slow-moving emergency.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from Paramount Agricultural Companies, growing healthy food for you and your family.
From the California Channel at the State Capitol, Valley PBS, and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Recently, the nonpartisan Little Hoover Commission published a report entitled Governing California Through Climate Change. We're delighted to welcome Carol D'Alia, the executive director of the Little Hoover Commission, back to the Maddie Report to talk about the findings. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on your program today.
So climate change. Is it real? What does the data show?
Not only is it real, but it's already happening. What we've found in our study is we're already beginning to see the effects, and this is going to be a new environmental reality. We're going to have a rising Pacific Ocean. We're going to have a longer and more dangerous fire season. We're going to have changes in precipitation patterns, meaning it's going to rain more on certain times, and we'll have drought just as we're experiencing now. We'll have less snowpack in the hills.
So just to be clear about this, what we're talking about is not what's causing climate change. That's a separate question. What we're talking about, is it happening? And you're saying yes. So the question is this: is climate change reversible or is it inevitable?
Well, what the scientists say is it's already happening now. So, but there is hope. And so what we were told is mitigation is going to continue to be important, meaning doing things to reduce the effects of climate change. We're already, it is inevitable, but we can control how severe it's going to be.
So you've reviewed lots of government studies, and you said, you know, there are some threats that you've identified. One you've talked about is I think, sea level. But we're talking just inches here. So what's the big deal?
Well, the big deal is California has 1,100 miles of coastline. And so even though we're talking inches, we're talking what the scientists say by 2030, potentially 2 to 12 inches, that's a foot. By 2100, it could be anywhere from 17 inches to 66 inches. That's 5 feet. That is a big deal.
So if we have a 1 foot of water rise, how much beach do we lose? Do we lose a lot of beach with that 1 foot? Is just 1 foot of beach or a lot more beach than that?
Well, you're not only just losing beach, but you also have to think about things like storm surge. So when we have violent storms that come, more airports are going to be, well, San Diego Airport, San Francisco Airport, potentially are going to be underwater and underwater more frequently. The roads leading to our ports. So this has an effect on our economy.
One answer might be hydroplanes, I guess. Okay, let's talk about violent storms. You mentioned that and inland flooding. We already have strong storms and inland flooding. How much worse can it get?
Well, what they told us during the course of our study is that the annual precipitation is not going to change much from now, but its seasonal timing is going to shift. So these storms are going to be larger. They're going to dump more rain in a short amount of time, which is going to overflow our creeks and our rivers.
So like flash flooding, things like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. So what was once a 100-year flood, a 500-year flood, is now going to happen multiple times within one lifetime.
Wow. Let's talk about agriculture for a second. What impact is climate change going to have on agriculture? It's a $45 billion industry in California.
Right. Well, we've already talked a little bit about drought. We also might have issues with saltwater intrusion, again, as the ocean moves into the delta, and the delta is where we send our fresh water south. We potentially will have issues with the water flowing south to our Central Valley farms. Some of the crops might begin to bloom differently, coming out of sync with their pollinators. There might be pest invasions. farmers might need to rethink what types of crops they're growing. Citrus, wine grapes, cherries may need to move to a cooler climate. Dairy cows in the Central Valley might provide less milk. So these are all the types of things that potentially need to be thought about as far as agriculture.
So the Pacific Northwest might become the new Napa Valley for wine. Let's talk about, you talked about severe droughts. We're going through one right now. Mm-hmm. Is what we're going through a prologue for what's to come?
Yes, potentially. What we've been told is with climate change, there'll be less snowpack. So the snowpack has traditionally been our water storage, handy water storage for the state of California. If you have less snow and you have more rain, you have to think about capturing the water in a different way. And the challenge here is that we can't look back historically what's happened because things are changing. So we need to think about what is being projected and to plan for that.
You also mentioned, I was reading your report, and it said that extreme heat is going to impact real estate and property values. How so?
Well, in the inland zip codes, it's going to be much hotter. So that's going to obviously be a less desirable place to live. The coast, meanwhile, is going to remain expensive. California might have to remake its whole landscape with more people living in the more temperate coastal environment. The scientists have said extreme heat days, which means anything over 95 degrees, are going to double in the San Joaquin Valley and triple in the Inland Empire.
Yeah, so it's interesting. All the growth really is in the Inland Empire and the San Joaquin Valley, and this may actually reverse that that trend. One last quick question. We've only got 30 seconds left in the segment. That's on wildfires. I was surprised to find that's the most common disaster in California and the third highest source of death, injury, and damage. And you're projecting, your study says, it's actually going to increase in frequency.
Yes.
That's amazing. What are the implications?
Well, we've already seen, since 2000, we've had the three hottest wildfire years in the history of record keeping since the 1950s. Also in that time frame, we've had the three largest as far as acreage burned. So, for example, 2013, we had the Rim Fire. That's the second largest wildfire in the state of California. So we're going to have to be prepared for a much more dangerous and longer fire season.
We're talking with Carol D'Elia of the Little Hoover Commission about a recently published report that they did called Governing California Through Climate Change. So what's the government doing to help Californians adapt to the inevitability of climate change? California's long been the front runner when it comes to some areas of climate change. What have been their more notable achievements?
Well, the most notable achievement I would have to say is the Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006. And in that—
Is that AB 32?
AB 32, where we said that we would roll back carbon emissions to 1990 levels by 2020 and 80% of 1990 levels by 2050. Another area where we've excelled that sometimes is not brought to the forefront as much as it maybe could is energy efficiency. The standards were set in the 70s, and while our population has grown, our electricity use has remained flat. So we've done amazing things there, which means less power plants getting built, also good for the environment.
Yeah, so you're pretty much laudatory in terms of the state's dealing with greenhouse gases. You're less sanguine when it comes to the state's strategies to adapt to the impacts of climate change. Why?
Well, a lot has not been done in that area. The California Resources Agency has led an exercise called California Climate Adaptation Strategy. They put together a report in 2009 and recently updated it. But if you look at the grand scheme, we, with the AB 32, with the greenhouse gas regulations, you have the California Air Resources Board, which is now directing hundreds of millions, potentially billions, to mitigation efforts. At the same time, with adaptation, you're really going to impact the lives of Californians. Is the airport open? Can I get to work? And we've put a minuscule effort forth. We think that it should be equal. We should have at least as much effort going towards adaptation planning as we have mitigation.
Okay. But there is something called the state's climate action team. What about them?
Well, the Climate Action Team is sort of a cross-jurisdictional grouping of various departments that come together and have done planning. Again, there's a lot of planning that's been going on and a lot of studies, but there hasn't been, and this is what local governments and regional consortia have told us, there really isn't an action plan of what they need to do.
Okay, so what about the legislature? Now, they've done some things with AB 32, but have they done anything, in your mind, in terms of the impacts of climate change?
Not really. As you indicate, they've done quite a bit on the mitigation side, but on the adaptation side, there hasn't really been a lot of activity. Now, I will say, in 2013 and 2014, four hearings were held. There was an Assembly Select Committee on Sea Level Rise in the California Economy. And as a result of that effort, legislation was recently enacted that requires the state to plan for a sea level rise database. So it seems as if the legislature is beginning to recognize that adaptation is going to be important.
So it seems that the legislature, or the government generally, is more focused on learning about climate change and determining exposure than really this adaptation. Should the government be doing more than simply learning about climate change and determining exposure?
Absolutely. That's where our commission comes out in our report. It's definitely time for us to stop studying and planning, and now is the time for action.
So what about local decision makers? So an individual decision maker at the local level doesn't have the time to study this issue. How do they make good decisions?
Well, that's where the state needs to play a role. That's exactly what we were told. The local government officials said, we don't have the time to be scientists. We don't have the time to sift through all these studies to determine what we need to plan for. And that's the role that the state could play in both providing the science and in having a common risk assessment so that people know what to plan for. Now, the local governments were very impressive. They know they need to do something. They're just not quite sure yet what it is they need to do.
So they're turning to the state government saying, tell us exactly what to do specifically.
Yes.
Okay, what about at the regional level? Is anything happening at the regional level? Because these problems don't stop at county lines,
mm-hmm.
Or city lines, for that matter. I mean, what's happening at the regional level?
Well, during the course of our study, we had three hearings, and one hearing was focused entirely on local and regional efforts to address climate change adaptation efforts. Mm-hmm. So you have in the Bay Area, you have the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, which is actually a state entity, but they have taken a leadership role and are probably further along than anybody. And they've brought together all of the different jurisdictions to attempt to plan for, because they have such a large coastline with the Bay. Mm-hmm. You also have efforts in LA, in San Diego, and in Sacramento. And then these regions have come together to form a statewide collaborative. So there's quite a bit going on there.
But not the Valley, apparently. Not yet. Okay. Well, hopefully they'll do something as well. We're talking with Carol D'Elia of the Little Hoover Commission about a recent report entitled Governing California Through Climate Change. You say that addressing the impacts of climate change is, quote, an historic challenge for governing, unquote. How so?
Well, it's the potential magnitude of climate impacts on California, how it will affect our quality of life, our Pacific Rim economy. So it's something that is going to be huge, and yet we haven't focused very much on it. A recent poll has found the majority of Californians now believe that climate change is going to affect them in their lifetime, and yet we've dedicated minuscule resources to it.
I've actually seen two polls. One was put out by the California Business Roundtable in Pepperdine, showing that 71% of voters view climate change impacts as, quote, either serious or, unquote, or moderate, unquote, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a PPIC study, Public Policy Institute of California, that said that 61% say global warming will pose a, quote, serious threat in their lifetime. And that's mm-hmm. up from 45% in 2003. So people are paying attention. It's also interesting that Latinos say that's a problem. 81% of Latinos say that's a problem. So it seems to be trending that people mm-hmm. are understanding this is an issue. Your report also cites some impediments to action. And one thing you have in there is something called, I hope I say this right, stationarity.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that? What's stationarity?
So stationarity is a term describing the fixed, predictable geography. It's what people take for granted. It's what has existed as long as they can remember. So, for example, the course of a river can be predicted by looking at the conditions of the past. Well, going forward, stationarity is going to be irrelevant. So we're going to have to base planning not on the past, but what people are predicting for the future. And so that's really a challenge. That's it's a little frightening to know that everything we've learned historically is now not going to be as helpful to us as we go forward. So that's a stumbling block.
Yeah, so you think what is will always be not true.
Right.
And so you can't also rely then, like you're saying, on historical data. That becomes irrelevant because things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
Things are changing. I want to ask you also about, the report refers to a second obstacle to action. And there you have an interesting term. You say it's the dictatorship of the present.
Mm-hmm.
What's the problem there?
Well, what that is essentially current taxpayers and their government not wanting to put money towards something that's going to benefit the future. So historically, that's just been a really hard sell.
So it's kind of like the slow-moving crisis, right?
Mm-hmm.
We'll worry about it when it gets here.
Right, but it'll be a lot more expensive if we wait.
Right, that's usually the situation. I remember seeing a billboard one time, it was for dentists, and it showed a person with no teeth, and they said, ignore this problem, and it will go away. So anyway, so you also cite the lack of clear, quantifiable, and adaptation goals. What would you consider clear and quantifiable adaptation goals? What would you like to see?
Okay, so it's easy to see when you're looking at mitigation. As I said earlier, you've got the greenhouse gas emission reduction goals.
To 1990
by 2020.
Right.
You don't have anybody saying, let's reduce the wildfires to 1990 levels by 2020, or let's ensure that by 2100, everyone is building with 6 feet of sea level rise in mind. There just haven't been goals. And part of the problem is, it isn't as easy to identify and pick a goal as it is with emissions reductions, because there's lots of different goals, and the goals are going to be different. In the Central Valley, you're going to be worried about heat, drought. On the coast, it's going to be sea level rise. So it really has to, there's a lot of different goals and a lot of priorities, and it'll be essential to look not just at a region, but also down to a neighborhood and a block level. So it's a lot harder to come up with an easily quantifiable goal, and that's part of the problem.
Yeah, I think the issue also is quantifiable goal. I think if you focus people on a quantifiable goal, they're more likely to hit it than some nebulous general standard.
Mm-hmm.
Your report also cites some institutional barriers to climate adaptation. What are some of those barriers?
Well, institutions work best when circumstances don't change. So clearly, that's no surprise. In a changing climate, they're not going to be ready to deal with the impacts of change. So at the federal level, they've barely just started to take notice. The states have lacked leadership at the highest levels. They're still planning historically. Maybe it's because of mandates. Maybe it's because that's the way that things have always been done. At the local level, you have even less resources and less funding to deal with this. So they're just not designed to deal with a climate change.
And it's a new thing, so I'm guessing you don't have experienced leadership out there.
Exactly.
So that's a problem. You probably, and also we were mentioning earlier, because it's something that's long term, you don't have public pressure. People don't feel like we need to deal with it right away because this is something that's going to happen in 2050.
Right. The public, unless something happens like a Hurricane Sandy, when suddenly there's a huge wake-up call and people realize things have changed and we need to do something, California hasn't had its Hurricane Sandy. So.
But isn't that, you know, that's kind of traditional with a democracy. It's very good at responding to a crisis, not so good at anticipating the crisis.
But we see that this is coming. Scientists are telling us it's going to come. We're making investments in infrastructure. We should at least be making the taxpayer dollars go as far as they can towards infrastructure that's going to be here in 30 or 40 years and not underwater.
So be fiscally prudent by dealing with the problem now instead of waiting till later.
Exactly.
Okay. We're talking with Little Hoover Commission's Executive Director, Carol D'Alia, about their report entitled Governing California Through Climate Change. You know, it's traditionally your commission rarely proposes, you know, new agencies to solve problems. I mean, your basic belief is that the current state agencies can solve any new problems that arise. But here you're saying it's different and that we need a new organization. Why? And exactly how would it operate?
Okay, so our commission really struggled with this recommendation. And on the one hand, the status quo clearly isn't working. On the other hand, as you indicated, we're rarely in a position where we want to create a new layer of bureaucracy. So at one point, the commission just decided, you know, whether it's a new entity or an existing entity, we're just going to focus on what this needs to do, what are its functions, and not worry so much about what form it might take. So the functions that it needs to provide. It needs to be the central clearinghouse where local and regional efforts can look to find a standard risk assessment. It needs to be advised by an independent science board so that, as I said earlier, the local officials don't want to be scientists. They don't want to read a lot. It needs to be the authoritative source so that locals know what to plan for. If in fact the legislature and the governor decide they want a new entity, we also felt strongly that it needs to have a voice, not of just state government, but of local officials as well. And it needs to be representative of both the public and the private sector interests in California.
I think you also read in your report that you're saying that the state Strategic Growth Council, their sustainable communities grant-making process could be expanded to include adaptation to climate change.
Yes, that was one of our recommendations. We thought that they were perfectly situated. They're already looking at the Sustainable Communities Grants.
And it fits in. It seems like a logical extension. Another one of your report's recommendations is that the climate risk assessment should be part of all public planning and governing in California. It seems like a pretty large undertaking. How would that work?
Well, although it seems like a large undertaking, as I said previously, we don't want to invest taxpayer dollars in infrastructure that's not going to be viable going forward. So adaptation planning should be part of hazard mitigation planning. It should be part of general plans. It should be part of local and state planning processes. And those who are doing that sort of planning should be rewarded as far as when it comes to the grant-making process.
So you want to go back to the discussion about the Strategic Growth Council. One of the things you recommend is that their mission be expanded to include climate change adaptation. Mm-hmm. Exactly what would that mean?
Well, today they tilt toward mitigation, so they have grant-making authority. They've actually, as far as Los Angeles and Santa Clara, have given out some grant money towards adaptation. So they're actually already kind of right on the fence of doing it. And we just thought that given their role in mitigation, and we've been told that some of the SB 375, the sustainable communities, might actually be driving population into areas that are dangerous. So if you have the same entity looking at adaptation, you could have that sort of a balance. So they just seemed to fit as far as being able to look at both mitigation as well as adaptation.
And you also said something in there about that they should review the state's five-year infrastructure plans to increase emphasis on adaptation. You think that's a good idea as well?
Yeah, they already have a role in doing that. And so in looking at the state's five-year plan, they should be looking to ensure that state government is thinking about the future and how we will adapt to the changing climate.
Right, so when we're building a university or whatever,
exactly.
State spends a lot of money on infrastructure, so they need to be thinking about these issues. You also mentioned in your recommendations that the state should more aggressively enforce, quote, defensible space requirements, and I think you're talking about wildfires there. Why aren't they doing it now, and why is a more aggressive enforcement position needed?
Well, the law already exists that in fire-prone areas, property needs to have 100 feet of defensible space. So the law is already on the books. The challenge is it's enforced by counties. So over the course of this study, we were presented with a model county, which is Ventura. So what Ventura does is they actively enforce that property owners are complying with the law. And if you don't comply, they will send somebody in to clear your space, and they will send you the bill, and they will fine you $600 on top of it. But I want to get to the success that they've had. So back in 2003, it was one of the worst wildfire years, one of those three top years for wildfires. There were 24 homes lost in Ventura County. Mm-hmm. In neighboring San Bernardino and San Diego, 3,600 homes.
Wow.
So
well,
it's
quite a difference.
Yeah.
We've only got about 30 seconds left, but I want to ask you this last question. That's about your recommendation that the governor should work with key stakeholders to identify the economic and legal impacts of rising sea levels. Well, okay, you identify the impacts, then what?
Well, the ocean is moving more towards property. California Constitution's public trust doctrine says that property on the ocean side of the mean high tide is publicly owned.
Oh, that's a mouthful.
Well, so what it means is private property is now going to become public property, and that's what the Constitution guarantees.
Okay.
So our recommendation was for the governor and the officials to get in front of it before it creates chaos in the courts.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Carol Dialli, with the Executive Director of Little Hoover Commission, for joining us.
Up next, what impact, if any, will climate change have on the Valley? We'll talk to Roger Isom, President and CEO of the Western Agricultural Processors Association, which represents tree nut haulers and processors of almonds, pecans, pistachios, and walnuts throughout California, and Mark Grassi, the award-winning environmental reporter for the Fresno Bee.
From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. So does climate change have any implications for the Valley? We're fortunate to have two guests who are well-versed on that issue. Roger Isom is the president and CEO of the Western Agricultural Processors Association. Welcome, Roger.
Welcome.
And Mark Grassi is an award-winning environmental reporter for the Fresno Bee. Welcome to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, Mark.
Thank you.
So, Mark, let me start with you. As you cover environmental issues in the Valley, do you find elected leaders in city and county government being skeptical or concerned about climate change?
I think everybody's becoming more concerned, especially when you see a year as warm as this one. Everybody's concerned about water. Everybody's concerned about catching up with California's groundbreaking climate change rules. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's the direction it's going.
Are you seeing any local proposals to deal with climate change?
You're seeing the things that you have to do to structure planning and to get funding for projects without being sued, so to speak. It's the framework that the state has set up, and I think that's kind of forcing some of the changes.
Are you seeing climate risk assessment and adaptation in their general plans or in their hazard mitigation plans at the local level?
At the local level, I have not seen that all that so much. Usually you're looking at that. That's part and parcel of getting it past the air quality standards, I think, and particularly water.
Yeah.
That's the big issue.
So you're seeing it coming under that. You know, the Little Hoover Commission report on climate change refers to this thing called the, quote, dictatorship of the present, unquote, as an obstacle to government action. In other words, politicians have a tendency to focus on immediate needs, which are politically popular, rather than dealing with problems that seem far out in the future. Do you agree that this could be a problem when it comes to addressing climate change? What do you think, Mark?
Well, yeah, I think you definitely run into that whenever you're talking about a political system. But again, I think there's enough rules in place now where you're going to have to push forward on this agenda. At least that's the way it's looking to me.
So, Roger, do you think that there are enough rules in place to get government officials' attention, or is this thing too far out for them to think about?
No, I think we're already seeing some examples of just what you're asking about there, and one of them is one of the first things on greenhouse gases that they wanted to address was renewable energy. Let's shift. It's real easy. Go to solar. Go to wind. Let's shift to that. So they come up with a requirement to meet a 20% and now a 33% renewable portfolio standard. And what happens is that two things have happened. One, the cost for that energy is much more than what conventional is. I mean, renewable energy, at least 8 cents and above. Your conventional energy, coal, hydro, natural gas, is 1 to 6 cents. So you've greatly added to the cost of energy. But then you've also created a problem where, like now, we're seeing everybody switch to solar. And so the peak used to be 12 noon to 6. Now it's actually 6 to 8. I was just at a PG&E meeting where they brought that up. And so what happens is you have this big shift and big mandate to meet renewable energy, but you've created a problem where you don't have reliable energy. What do you do? I mean, renewable energy is great when the sun is shining and the wind is blowing, but when you get to those evening hours and you have all this demand, what do you do?
Right, yeah. You still have to have something to deal with that, whether it's natural gas or hydro or whatever. Let me ask you this, Roger. How do folks in ag feel about the issue of climate change? Do they see it as a threat or a hoax?
I agree with Mark. I think people are starting to feel it, but I think ag is more concerned about the regulatory impact that we're seeing already. What's the cost of cap and trade? We're already seeing that with some of our tomato processing plants. Some of the regulations that they're talking about in their latest update, talking about methane capture, regulating fertilizer applications, things like that, even controlling or mandating irrigation efficiencies. I think that's the biggest concern. And then you add on what the threat that we've heard, the cost of fuels as they bring fuels under the cap.
But do they believe it's legitimate? I mean, do they see there's a need for these regulations? Or they say this is just some scientists speculating?
I, I don't know. I think just the biggest concern is still what's going to happen to us from a regulatory standpoint. They're not even thinking about whether or not this is true or not.
So it's not a theoretical, philosophical discussion. It's more practical, and how is it impacting my bottom line?
Absolutely.
Well, let me ask you this. Generally, what impact, if any, has it had then on agriculture? Is it impacted some crops, specific crops, more than others?
It's different, right? For cotton, for example, we've seen increased yields 3 years in a row. I think there's been a lot of studies out there that say cotton actually likes the longer growing season, likes the hotter temperatures, and will do quite well. In fact, some studies say 20 to 33% increase in yield. Now, others, like stone fruit and some of those, where they rely upon those chilling hours, are going to see going to have a problem because they're not there as much. And so there's going to be winners and losers, I think.
Yeah, and then Little Hoover Commission report, they're indicating that strawberries and almonds are going to do well with the change in the climate, but cherries and wine grapes, problematic. They also said that citrus is very temperature sensitive as well. So that could change things. And then there's also dairy. They said their argument in listening to this report was that heat stressed Central Valley dairy cows might produce less milk. Have you heard that?
That's true.
That is true. Okay. So in an effort to address climate change, California has enacted some pretty aggressive cap and trade schemes, a scheme. And I think Mark Rossi was alluding to that earlier. The ultimate goal is to bring California's statewide greenhouse gas emissions down to 1990 levels by 2020. And while the California's cap and trade program, when fully implemented, covers about 85% of California's economy, the LAO at least has reported that agriculture is not subject to cap and trade regulation. Is it covered by cap and trade? And if not, why not?
No, it is definitely covered. We have right now, up until January 1, there's 386 facilities statewide subject to cap and trade. 38 of those, or almost 10%, are ag. They're vegetable dehydrators. They're all the tomato processing plants. One of the nut processors, one of my members, is subject to cap and trade. You got beef packers, corn milling. The 38 of those facilities subject to cap and trade. In fact, we've been talking about it as what's the cost back to the grower in terms of tomato processing, things like that. So, no, we're definitely subject to it. And if they follow through with the legislation this year, that's coming this next year, to go to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050, that's going to bring them all in.
Okay. So you're seeing a direct cost then of cap and trade in the ag industry?
Absolutely. Because they, like everything else, has to pass it on. We're the end of the road. We can't pass that cost along as growers, but processors or our fuel suppliers, they're all passing it on back to us.
Can you give our listeners kind of an understanding of exactly if they're going to buy a tomato? Or something, how it's going to directly impact their cost? Because food generally is very price sensitive.
That's right. They're not. The individual buyer is not, because you're going to get processing tomatoes from China or some other place that can do it without these rules and regulations. So the person that has to eat it is either the processor or the grower.
What about, I'd read somewhere about the fact that ag might be able to use, you know, their row crops or their trees as an offset, because they're using carbon. Is that something that's...
The state and even the federal government is looking at that, but none of the protocols have been approved. The rice industry is looking at one right now, potentially, but it's not to the point of being approved yet. Forestry is the only one that has anything that's approved.
So, Mark, what are you hearing in terms of your reporting on cap and trade and how it's impacting agriculture when you talk to folks?
I think you're talking about, like Roger's saying, this is a $37 billion industry in this valley. It's huge. And I think anytime you have an impact from something like this, it's going to ripple through everywhere. My question has been all along, though, how do they account for the carbon dioxide sequestration of plants? It's aside from creating the gases, what's the net increase you get when you factor in the fact that there's all kinds of biomass here that's creating the clean air and buffering things? I haven't heard any discussion about that.
Yeah, I think that there has been some talk about possibly bringing that up, but I don't think the folks at ARB have really addressed that at this point. Roger?
No, they haven't.
You have cap and trade here in California, but firms outside, as Roger was mentioning, whether it's international, even within the United States, don't have these really rigorous cap and trade rules we have here in California. So there have been efforts to increase the value added side of agriculture here in the Valley, including food processing. So I'm just wondering, Roger, will cap and trade adversely affect the efforts of Valley to increase the export of ag commodities in terms of being both the producer and processor of food?
Absolutely. In fact, we're already seeing it. Just look at putting AB 32, our greenhouse gas regulations, to the side at the moment. When you compare our state to other states or other countries, average worker in cotton gin in California makes $10.35 an hour. That same worker in Mexico is $10 a day, and that same worker doing the same job in Uzbekistan is $10 a week, yet we're all getting paid the same for the cotton. How do you do that? USDA does a research paper, a survey, every 3 years, comparing ginning costs in California to other states. And on average, we're $10 per bale higher than any other state across the country. And in fact, if you look at our fuel—
Based on what? On regulations alone? On labor costs? On everything?
On everything. But it's, you know, primarily being driven by regulations.
Well, we can't lower our rates to $10 a week to compete with Uzbekistan or something. So what do we do?
Absolutely. Well, what's happened, and I'll give you two specific examples. One of them is we have a walnut processor that is in Northern California. They looked at the cost, workers' compensation, energy, air pollution regulations, and said, you know what? We're moving our processing operation to Sparks, Nevada. They did that over two years ago now. And even including the cost, they still grow the walnuts here, but they truck them over Donner Pass to Sparks, Nevada, process them there, and then bring them back to the Port of Oakland to export them. Even with that transportation cost, they're still saving money. That's incredible.
And then the question is, those trucks driving back and forth, are they adding to greenhouse gases, and are we shooting ourselves in the foot? That probably would be an argument.
Absolutely could be. Okay. And same thing with dairies. We have dairies that are moving out of California to Idaho and other states for the same reasons as regulatory concerns.
Mark Rossi with the Fresno Bee, are you hearing that when you talk to folks in the industry?
Absolutely. That is one of the big hurdles the Valley has to face, is the increase in environmental regulation. It's happening on all fronts. It's not just here, but what I'm saying is the farmer is facing a whole array of things, and they have to hire consultants, and they have to spend a lot more time dealing with things like salinity in the water, the greenhouse gases. It's a whole different ballgame now.
Yeah. Raj, let me ask you this. According to the legislative analysts, the money generated through cap and trade could be used to improve water efficiency. Could ag in the Valley benefit from that cap and trade money?
Potentially, yes. And the first thing I would say is it should be standard policy that if you're taking revenue from cap and trade, it needs to go towards reductions for greenhouse gases. That's the basic premise that should be there. There is a program through CDFA called the State Water Efficiency and Enhancement Program, SWEEP, as it's known. It's $10 million administered by CDFA for improving, switching from furrow or flood irrigation to drip, reducing pumping either through variable speed drives or other programs. And so as long as there's greenhouse gas reductions tied to that, then you can get that money. But it's only $10 million out of the pot of money.
Yeah, $10 million is, I don't want to say a drop in the bucket, use a pun here, but that's really not a lot of money when you talk about a $108 billion state budget, and who knows how much cap and trade is bringing in. But if you say drip, you can use it for drip irrigation, which I don't quite understand how what does that have to do with greenhouse gas emissions?
So the theory is, and again, you have to prove this, you've got to go through a calculation, but the theory is that you're pumping less water because you're switching to drip. And so if you're pumping less, that means your whatever engine you're using to drive that pump is operating less, and therefore you got less greenhouse gas emissions.
Are they providing any money so you can change out some of these pumping machines to be more efficient, use less energy? Are they helping you in that regard?
Yes. Yeah, the only one that they're not, that program isn't doing is replacing the pump engine itself. There are other programs through air districts and that where you can replace that diesel engine over to a electric motor or a diesel to a cleaner burning diesel engine.
But that's been going on for quite some time, hasn't it?
Yes.
What would you guesstimate? I'm putting you on the spot here a little bit. Would you guesstimate has been the conversion of those dirtier diesel pumps in ag to more clean burning, electric pumps?
Yeah, you're all putting me on the spot. But I would say we know that the Ag Ice program, which was a program with the utilities to convert diesel to electric, we did over 2,000 engines to electric motors in that program alone. We believe that growers on their own, because of either other air pollution regulations or other controls, other reasons, switched at least another 2,000 to 2,500 pumps.
Yeah, it's amazing. Ag is very efficient, and they'll keep a machine going forever. Yeah. And so unless you provide some kind of incentive to change, they'll probably keep using it. Well, up next, we're going to dig deeper into the issue of developing a reliable source of water in light of changes in the climate. That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're talking to Roger Isom, President and CEO of the Western Agricultural Processors Association, and Mark Grassi, an environmental reporter for the Fresno Bee. So, Mark, let me ask you, the state generally, and the Valley in particular, have been experiencing a severe drought. No news to anyone. Could this be a prologue of what's to come? Is this the new normal?
Well, I got to say, I think probably we're going to see more dry weather in the future and warmer weather. I've been talking with climatologists the last week about this very topic, and one of them mentioned to me the 2006 heat wave we went through, where it was 113 for like 3 days in a row, and the low temperature was around 95. He said that's going to be the new a mild form of the new norm in the next 50 years. And following right on the footsteps of that is dry weather. There's in the past we've had dry periods that have lasted decades, sometimes centuries, in this state. So yeah, I think that's on its way.
Mark, I'm sorry, Roger. What do you think? Are droughts the new normal?
Well, I'm not a climatologist, so I'm not even going to hazard a guess on this one. I have no idea. Okay. I hope not.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you go back and take a look at the research that Mark Rossi was talking about. There have been droughts in California back through the, you know, centuries that go on for like 100 years, a really long period of time. So these 3 or 4 year droughts are really nothing compared to what we've seen in California in the past. Well, Roger, let me ask you this. See if you want to answer this question in terms of dams. That's being offered as one solution to mitigate the impact of climate change. But how much can dams help if we have less snowpack?
Well, first thing I'd say, it's definitely not the only solution out there. But I think that they play a role. Certainly, we're still going to have some wet years. And I think that we need to be able to capture any potential runoff there in those wet years for the critically dry years.
Mark Rossi, what do you think? Dams have been offered as a possible solution, but then other people say, you know, snowpack's going to be not what it used to be. Roger's saying, well, even there are going to be years when it is going to be good, we should still try to save it. What do you think? What does the science say?
I think Roger's right. I think this is one of several things you need to think about. But if you look on the Colorado River, you have more storage, a lot more storage on that river than you do here in California. And they go many years with drought. And they're not great, but they're coming to the end of the line, but they have a lot of storage. And since I think we're going to get a little more the precipitation more in the form of rainfall instead of snow, it's a better idea to have something maybe a little bit bigger to catch it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm doing some research for the program and found that the State Department of Water Resources has forecasted that the Sierra snowpack will see a 25 to 40% reduction in its historical average by 2050. And UCLA has done some modeling, and they have found that mountain ranges in Southern California could lose up to 42% of their annual snowpack by 2050. And they are planning studies for the Sierra as well. It's interesting.
Those are big numbers. Those are big numbers, but I got to tell you, this is the southern part of the range, and it's higher. The snowfall here is going to hold up longer than it is to the north. Yes. So just consider that, too.
Yeah, it's interesting. When we look out over the mountain ranges in the valley, just hoping to see a lot of white on the top of those mountains. Roger, let me ask you this. So besides dams or other things that can be done, what do you think the state should be doing to ensure a reliable source of water?
Well, I think there's several things. One, you got to look at groundwater recharge wherever you can and encourage the local irrigation districts and cities and counties where you can. get innovative. One of the things we're looking at is floodwater recharge. We actually have a grower right now that's developing an infrastructure and system to capture floodwater off the Kings River. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, he's actually not building a basin, but flooding his existing land, in this case a vineyard, and then that water will recharge the underground aquifer. I think you need to look at, obviously, like the programming, encouraging efficiencies where you can and where they can afford it. You've got to look at what we're doing as well, developing drought-tolerant varieties. We're looking at ones that might use a half an acre foot less water than what it is right now. And then finally, I think, you know, one that's obviously not going to be popular, but it's going to be one that's going to happen or try to happen, and that's fix the delta so that we don't have, you know, a million acre feet going out under the Golden Gate that we could have captured and used in a year like this. Right.
They've been working on that for decades, and we'll see what happens there. But let me talk, Roger, about these local efforts. You know, one thing you're seeing in some communities are these things called purple pipes, where they're repurposing water for, like, parks and things like that. Are we going to see more of that, you think?
I think so. They have it. Tarabella is one of the most impacted communities out there, and they do have a water system similar to that. So residents there can use that water really just for irrigation. They don't use it inside the house to drink with, but they can use that water instead. So,
what do you think about incentivizing folks for like putting in, let's say, fake lawns, but in taking out their front lawns? A lot of people, a lot of homeowners have front lawns, and they're actually in Los Angeles. There, a lot of them are changing with help from the Los Angeles Metropolitan Water Group down there to give folks some money so they can actually change their lawns to so they don't have to use any water. Do you think that's something that's going to get people happen here in the Valley?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that concept's already catching on. Just on my block alone, the fourth house this year is putting in a fake lawn.
Yeah. It's interesting. My wife is pushing for that, too, so I may be doing that as well. Well, Mark, let me ask you. From your reporting, what are you seeing as the most likely local approaches to ensuring a reliable source of water for people and businesses and agriculture?
Well, I think you're seeing a lot more discussion of that, and I think that's the biggest thing is we all get on board and start talking about it. In Fresno, they're talking about making more use of the surface water that's available. There's two sizable rivers on either side of Fresno, and to use the surface water wisely in conjunction with the groundwater, I think is the best way to approach it. And up to now, we haven't done a whole lot of intelligent use that way, I don't think, in California. The groundwater law that they passed, I think, is going to put some put a little bit more backbone in it, and people will be able to share the water fairly.
But that's going to be a bit controversial, though.
It's a real difficult situation.
Isn't that going to be a bit controversial, though, these groundwater regulations, when you tell someone they can't pump as much as they want to pump?
Well, I mean, that's really not the point at first. At first, it's finding out how much is being pumped and finding out where it's being pumped and just defining what it is we have. I mean, right now, it's a huge mystery, and it's probably as bad. A big mystery here as it is anywhere in the country, and it's strange. I mean, it's at least we need to understand what we have before we manage it.
Yeah, it's interesting that there's confidentiality surrounding where they're pumping and how much they're pumping. I guess they're sending that information to the state, but it's not going to be disclosed, I guess, generally to the public. So as surface water, if you take surface water, that stuff does have to be disclosed. So that's kind of interesting. But let me ask you this last question. Roger, we'll start with you. Little Hoover Commission's report recommends that the governor should work with key stakeholders to identify the economic and legal impacts of climate change. So, okay, we identify the impacts. Then what?
Well, the first thing is you need to have a clear understanding of who else is doing it. You know, when they started this whole climate change thing, it was under the Western Climate Initiative. And you had 11 Western states and 4 Canadian provinces. And today you've got one state and partially one Canadian province that's looking at cap and trade in the form of Quebec. Nobody else is doing that. The single biggest issue we have with this, all these climate change regulations is the level playing field. It's already not level. Now you're exacerbating that by passing all of these additional controls and regulations. It's just going to make it to the point where we can't compete. That's got to be understood, and it's got to be factored in somehow, some way, so that we can address what needs to be addressed, but still stay in business. How they do that, you know, you have to have a more open dialogue than what they're having right now. They've got to stop at some point, reassess what's going on. For example, this renewable portfolio standard where they're looking at going to 50%. We already talked about that, what the unintended consequences were from that. We need to understand that before we move forward. And we've already seen manufacturing leave California from the criteria pollutant regulations, like Fruhoff here in Fresno, a trailer manufacturer that up and left because they couldn't comply with all the air quality regulations. We can't make that same mistake twice.
Well, I think we got you on a roll there, Roger. Let me ask Mark, what are your thoughts on this? So we get the stakeholders together, we talk about the economic and legal impacts of climate change. Well, then what?
Well, I think you have to figure out what's possible. I mean, I think it's a pretty grand idea to probably, you know, to try to take care of the world's problem right here from California. Like Roger says, you need to find out what everybody else is doing and try to get together with them. But that said, there are things you can do right here to be wiser and smarter with our technology and with our emissions. And I think that's where we're going to wind up. We're going to start on the ground here first, and then move out to a bigger, broader area. And if it's not economically feasible, I don't see how you can challenge the whole state to clean up the world, you know?
I guess we're going to see. I want to thank Mark Grassi, environmental reporter for the Fresno Bee, and Roger Eisen, president and CEO of the Western Agricultural Processors Association, for joining us. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, the Maddie Daily, by just logging on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.